it was really startling how unprepared the government was for the scale of carnage that took place during the Civil War.
It was literally unprecedented. I mean, last war we'd fought before the Civil War, the Mexican War, couple of years of combat, you know, maybe 2,500 battlefield deaths. I mean, that was the kind of thing that would have been predicted. It was predicted that there would be almost no bloodshed, that neither side would have the stomach to fight. And if there was fighting, no one had any context for understanding how extraordinarily lethal it was going to become, and become very, very quickly. So there were no preparations for caring for the wounded and the dying and the dead, no provisions for burying them in any way at that number, no provisions for notifying next of kin. I mean, really, at every level, from the most deeply personal to the most broadly governmental, there was simply no preparedness for this event. And like all events that are new and unprecedented, there was a tremendous, odd thing to think, generative power. I mean, people had to cope with new circumstances. And from individuals to groups and finally to larger states and the federal government itself, there's an enormous amount of improvisation that took place during the war as people struggled to figure out how to deal with this new reality.
And as usual, it took a group of women to help straighten things out for us.
It's stunning. You know, Clara Barton, you know, we have these names that kind of come up to us in history, as rightly they should, but it really was. I mean, from the beginning, you know, there's this patent clerk in the patent office in Washington, Clara Barton, who can see that Washington is just a tide of blood is washing, you know, up the Potomac, and there is no preparedness for it. And so she sets out to become kind of a one-woman, you know, ambulance corps. There was no ambulance corps. There was no, the United States government until 1864 had no ambulance corps for the Army of the Potomac, for any of its armies. So much of it was being done on a voluntary basis by people like Clara Barton, by the women and men who, you know, staffed the U.S. Sanitary Commission or the U.S. Christian Commissions. Those are all voluntary private organizations which are raising their own money and trying to help out. And in the South as well, where the circumstances were even worse, the resources were fewer on the ground, vastly less, fewer economic means to do so. Again, primarily women's groups across the South doing what they could to care for the wounded and try to bury the dead. But I mean, everyone was overwhelmed. Every system in place was overwhelmed. And that was really the experience during the war. And therefore, you had these horrific circumstances that not only were people dying by the hundreds of thousands, 750,000 now, in the new estimate that came out just last year, in a population of 30 million.
And someone mentioned,
if we had a comparable death rate, today, 2.5-3% of our 300 million Americans, that'd be 7 million people dead. Staggering,
unbelievable
rate of death.
Well, one thing that really struck me was the soldiers came to realize that they weren't getting many help from the government. They came to prepare for what they called the good death.
That's right. I mean, we have to understand that this is America, a profoundly religious, profoundly Christian country on the eve of the Civil War. And even though you had a much higher chance of dying, especially in childhood or childbirth, in the middle 19th century, you could absolutely expect to die at home, that you would be surrounded by friends and family and, you know, who could see that you were ready to die, to meet your maker, and had some kind of resolution. Now you're dying, not at home in your own bed, surrounded by your family, but you're dying on a battlefield that might be 1,000 miles away with strangers. How do you die a good death? This profoundly important feature of American spiritual and psychic life in the mid-19th century. And so you had this tremendously moving fact that soldiers would, you know, make pacts with each other. I will contact your family, you contact mine in the event of a lethal outcome. Please send this home to my wife or my daughter or my sister or my mother. The extremely moving fictions, which a surgeon might, in a letter home to grieving parents, say, you know, I didn't know your son well. In fact, he was a stranger to me, but he seemed to me at peace with himself and his God. So that people did whatever they could to, in these worst of all circumstances, somehow create some semblance of a good death, even as people were dying all around them. So very at that very intimate level, how do you confront and come to terms with death? There was no preparedness, and people were having to find and improvise and make up on the spot. You know, no dog tags. You sew a piece of paper, pin a piece of paper on the inside of your uniform, because the government doesn't give you a dog tag. There's no serial numbers. There's no bureaucracy that says, listen, the duty of care a government has to the people who fight and die in its name is such that we need to be able to identify them under any circumstance. That commitment, that responsibility was exactly what emerged from the war. It was the war that created the conditions under which it was absolutely necessary for the government to, in a sense, stand up and do what families and clan and kin had done before the war, which is take care of the dead, bury the dead, honor the dead. That was a profoundly personal, private, family ritual that in the course of the Civil War and in the years afterwards was understood to be not just a family ritual, but it was a national ritual, hence the first cemeteries. You can't go to a Revolutionary War cemetery. There aren't any such thing. Our first national cemeteries emerged from the Civil War, in which we have so many people dying that it's understood that the government is, in fact, in loco parentis. When it asks citizens, not professional soldiers, these aren't West Pointers, these are, you know, nearly 3 million Americans, North and South, 2.1 million in the North, 850,000 in the South, who are mainly citizen soldiers fighting for the government. And when that happens, especially in a war perhaps, about the definition of citizenship as it came to be understood by 1863, boy, does the government have a duty of care in return, not just to those men who fall, in on the line, but to their families and the people who bear, the widows and orphans and family members who bear those burden and the pain for years to come. So that was a profound transformation at the governmental level. And in a way, it's sort of, she didn't put it this way, but Drew Faust, on whose marvelous book our film is based, This Republic of Suffering, in a sense, there's a way in which she's saying the New Deal began on the fields of Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what the impact was on all this carnage on the national psyche. I haven't really thought about that so much. I guess photography played a role, didn't it, at some point?
It did. I mean, one of the great turning points in the war, I mean, Antietam, was there any one battle that was more transformational than Antietam? I don't think so. And one of the ways it was transformational is there you had, in the days after the battle, of course you have hundreds, possibly thousands of bodies still unburied. And out come Matthew Brady's photographers. Here's a private photographic studio, this new thing, photography, coming out there to photograph the dead at Antietam. And boy, when those photographs appeared at Matthew Brady's daguerreotypist studio on the foot of Broadway in Manhattan 2 years later, I mean 2 months later in November of 1862, it had a huge impact. I mean, people there, now suddenly it was brought home in the North as it had been brought home over 2 years by then in the South, what the war was really about, that the war was not valor, not glory, not dying in a kind of a martial death, but was being obliterated on the field of battle and possibly almost certainly unrecognizable, way more than half the bodies not identified. And the New York Times, everybody who saw these photographs was absolutely transformed by them. And so it was really one of those moments where you sort of understood technology, the same technology in a way that was making the war so lethal, was also bringing us newfangled means like photography to make it apparent what death really was. And there was no outcry against it. It wasn't as if people were outraged to see these or felt they were made sober and solemn and helped really, really made people understand what the war was doing to Americans.
Mm. And you also spend a fair amount of time addressing the plight of African-American soldiers who went from slavery to the battlefield.
Boy, I mean, that's the experience of death was the general experience of Americans during those 4 years, and for Black Americans, it was all the more so. I mean, they had so many more ways to die. Always had. They could be killed summarily by masters. They could be killed trying to escape. Their mortality rate was already high. The mortality rate in the contraband camps, these camps where fugitive slaves who'd come across the Union lines, because African Americans knew the war unequivocally was about freedom, quite a bit before white Americans agreed that it was a war about freedom as well. But of course, as David Blight, the historian, wonderful Civil War historian, says in our film, for black Americans, freedom very, very often meant dying in a contraband camp, you know, in the Mississippi Valley or in Tennessee or in Washington, D.C. I mean, these were lethal death traps, as were all these camps. I mean, two out of three of the deaths in the Civil War came from disease and infection, not from a bullet on the battlefield. And that was true for civilians, these sort of large wash of civilian populations, our first refugee camps. And then, of course, you know, it took a couple years for black Americans to finally convince the government to let them fight and die in the name of freedom and the Union. And when they did, they died in greater numbers overall, partly because they were never treated as soldiers who needed to be, if they were captured, treated with the honor that soldiers, imprisoned soldiers, were meant to have. They weren't seen as soldiers. They were seen as slaves engaged in an uprising. So death for black Americans once they got into the war was also another thing as well. It was an even more lethal undertaking than it was for their white counterparts, as places like events like Fort Pillow, where, you know, there was simply no surrendering. You were executed if you surrendered. And black soldiers knew that and fought all the more determinedly because of that, because they knew that it was an absolute, you know, zero-sum game. You either prevailed or you died. There was nothing in between. So, again, one of the sort of remarkable things, I think, that Drew Faust sort of underscores is the way in which not only was the experience of death different for Americans, experienced differently than anything they had experienced before, there were differences among Americans. It was not the same white and South and North. It was not the same white and black.
I always remember the late Shelby Foote pointing out in your Civil War film that it was a hell of a crossroads.
It was a hell of a crossroads. You know, and we say that, and we kind of know that that's true, and here's yet another way, kind of this thing that's been staring at us in the face for 150 years, that, you know, war means death, and the Civil War was our biggest bloodbath, and the crossroads really was a crossroads that had everything to do with dying, and there was no aspect of the war that wasn't, in fact, transformed by that experience. I mean, from the religious experience of men trying to find out how to die a good death on the field of battle, to the government trying to figure out how do we bury, how do we, you know, take care, how do we learn to honor people when they die in this number, so the first national cemeteries. In so many different ways, the war was an engine of change, and indeed it was death itself that propelled initially as a military necessity the great political and moral transformation of the war. As by 1862, it's clear that you don't have enough, there are too many dead bodies. We don't have enough live ones. There are not enough people volunteering in the North. What are you going to do about that? And so death itself is an increasingly mass experience, is generating the idea we're going to have to move towards conscription. We're going to have to move towards emancipation. We're going to have to move towards allowing people, black Americans, to fight and die as well, because we need more live bodies to take the place of the dead ones that have fallen. So there's really no part of this crossroads where the experience of death, in a funny way, isn't standing at the front of the line and isn't the primary engine. And Drew's point, I think, was not to disregard everything else, not to say, oh, it's only about death, but to make sure that this experience, which was the dominant experience for Americans, I mean, 1 in 3 to 1 in 5 white men of military age dying in the South, that's an astonishing statistic. You were going to know someone who had lost someone. You were in the South. Every family was touched. Mm. That's the experience. That's the reality. And then how do you understand the causes, the consequences, all the manifold sort of currents and energies that were abroad during the war? But understand that for Americans, and increasingly, because the experience wasn't like a level experience of death. It was a constantly accelerating experience. I mean, for me, the most chilling fact that I kind of really had never focused on before was that by the end of 1863, by the time Lincoln is helping to dedicate the new federal cemetery at Gettysburg, only half of the deaths have occurred. That in the next year plus, in the next 15 months, we're going to have another half again as many dead. I mean, it's just astonishing that that 64 was what brought death on a level that was inconceivable, even by the standards the war itself had innovated.
And 150 years later, we're still learning from it.
We are, you know, and it's going to. And what we're learning is that it is, as Shelby put, the crossroads of our being. It defines us. It marks us. We're still, if not, it may be melodramatic to say we're still fighting the battles. We are still profoundly affected by those events, and they have not gone away, and they affect our politics and our culture and our psyches, even if we don't know that they're affecting them. That how is it that we live in a country with such profound differences about government? There are certain people in the country who feel that government is the agency of liberation, of opportunity, of the very basis of what it means to be an American. And there's another group of people in the country who can't begin to understand how you would feel that way, who feel that government should be as small as possible, as limited as possible, and that there's something essentially inimical to what it means to be an American about government. Wow, that's a huge, seismic difference. That's the difference that we still carry within us, along with many, many others.
And the film is going to coincide with the Battle of Antietam?
It does. It'll be broadcast on September 18th, the day after the 150th anniversary of Antietam, still the bloodiest, most lethal day in American history.
It's called Death in the Civil War, written and directed by Rick Burns. Will air on American Experience on September 18th. Rick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.